I spend a lot of my time telling the government they're wrong. That's what federal public defenders do. We tell the government they're wrong, and we argue that they're wrong, and we argue what they're trying to do to our clients is wrong. But we respect the system, and we were a part of the system, and we believe in the system. At that moment in time, not only did I not want to be a part of the system, but I didn't want to be an American. I was no longer proud of our system, and I was certainly not proud of our government.
Many a time, you know, I'd be sitting in my cell all alone, and I would have this slit in the wall that was about maybe 5 inches wide. That was the only window to the outside world. I would only see shadows and, you know, the colors of the sunset, but never really the sun. And I would sit there and wonder if I'm ever going to see a sunset again. Of course, to this day, not a single charge has been filed against GRF or against any of the employees of GRF, including myself.
I was acquitted from all charges, and in the media, the jurors were saying that we didn't know why they brought him to the case. They took the first decision in half an hour. They voted without any discussion that I was innocent of all charges.
They didn't have enough to bring criminal charges, to charge me as a criminal, as a terrorist. The only accusation they would make against me is that I had overstayed my visa.
I was acquitted. The second day in the morning, ICE came. My attorney asked the judge to release me, but the judge wouldn't accept that.
The lawyer had told them that, like, he should be out in, like, 2 or 3 days just until they process the paperwork and everything. And we kept waiting, and then they transferred him to the immigration facility. And every time we would keep trying, like, for the first, I think, week or two, like, even, like, my dad's lawyer couldn't get any information on what's going on. It wasn't something that was, like, unheard of, and it wasn't something like that I thought couldn't ever happen, because I saw it happen, or I've heard of it happening, but it was just, I didn't expect it to happen to my father.
I was denied bond based on the fact that they considered me a danger to the community, when my whole community was actually demonstrating and protesting and what have you. And they were treating me like the most dangerous, worst criminal ever. When I was taken from my cell to my first immigration hearing, the security they had was unbelievable. They had a sheriff's deputy stationed almost every 10 feet all the way from the door of my cell to the building almost next door. My trial was behind closed doors. I was put in solitary confinement on a floor all by myself in a very tight cell. And they had a camera fixed right on me. The cell door had a small window, and the camera was right there. It was clear then that this wasn't about immigration or me overstaying my visa or anything like that. They were going after me with everything they got.
One time I passed through the observation room of the guard, and I saw my picture there. So I asked one of the guards why my picture is there. He said, because you are a threat, and we have to keep an eye over you for 24 hours. And this was from ICE. They gave them this information.
The thing that got to me the most was just not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing whether I'll be able to see him again, whether he'll, you know, just be there for, like, these major events in our lives.
Very quickly, we presented to ICE that I have a passport. I don't need a visa. I can go tomorrow to my country, and I am willing to do that. They said, no, we have to wait.
He'll try appealing, and then there would be different court dates, and, like, nothing would come out of it, and then different promises. And then at the end, they t- told us if you just leave voluntarily, we promised he'll be on the flight with you. We kept expecting to find my father there, and he didn't show up. At the end, the immigration officer, he told him, he's like, I can't respond to your questions anymore.
After almost 3 years in prison, two of those in solitary confinement, Sami Hammoudi was found innocent of all terrorism charges. But instead of being released, he was transferred to an immigration jail. For 6 months, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused to either release or deport him, even after he agreed to voluntary deportation to reunite with his family. Hammoudi's lawyers brought ICE to court. 2 days before the trial, Hammoudi was deported in secret.
So on the 23rd, they took me to the airport and deported me. So it wasn't their plan to deport me this way. If we didn't go to the federal judge and ask him to either release me or deport me, they wouldn't do that.
We didn't even know, because we were used to him calling, and then he didn't call for 2 days, so we didn't know what was going on. And my mom called his lawyer, and he didn't, like, have an idea of what's going on. And we kept trying to get in touch with people. And, like, she was kind of freaking out because it was just, you couldn't get in touch with him. No one knew what was happening to him.
It's the humiliation of, being deported and traveling in a T-shirt and sweatpants and prison shoes and having these agents with you. It's especially for somebody who has my good name and my reputation are the only assets I have in this world. I mean, I don't have any money in any bank accounts. I don't have any land. I don't have any. But this is the only thing I have. And the U.S. government made sure to attack me on these two. They have ruined my reputation. They have ruined my good name. And they have accused me unjustly of things that are complete fabrications. They could not prove anything because there was nothing there. But with the USA Patriot Act, they didn't have to prove anything. It was enough for the government to say, we suspect.
They think that accusing people, destroying their lives, is something they can do. This is what worries me. It is the arrogance of the powerful.
Sometimes I think back and I don't even know. Like, it still seems like a dream away. And I don't really know how we got through all of it. It seems like it was something that even happened to someone else.
America before, I won't say before September 11th. America before the USA Patriot Act was one thing. And after the USA Patriot Act was a completely different country. I will not be exaggerating if I said America today is a police state just like any other third world police states.
It is actually the Dark Ages. It is the mentality of the Dark Ages, where governments could do anything they want to do.
In criminal court, the burden of proof is with the prosecution. They would have to make their case. They would have to prove. In immigration, all they have to do is just cast doubt upon them.
They do whatever they want to do. And they have the laws, they have everything they want to lie, even lie.
All these things that you hear about, freedom and, equality and all these other things, it just seemed like more and more of a facade. And it was just, I don't know, like the hypocrisy was just kind of overwhelming. And and just having to deal with that uncertainty on a daily basis was just very nerve-wracking and very exhausting. And
our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, The Orphan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on RMB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so obviously the title doesn't really indicate what I'm talking about. What I'm going to be talking about really are how we deal with hardships and sort of difficulties in life. And I'm going to refer to one of our more recent martyrs, who's actually a martyr of service, who is the former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi. And I'm also going to be talking a little bit about the life of Prophet Muhammad, because obviously one of the important things is when we're talking about challenges and difficulties, well, how do we deal with it? And what do some of the, what we would say, the purified people, and obviously the Holy Prophet is a prime example. He's considered the most oppressed of all the prophets. And obviously, when we look at the lives of all the prophets, it's almost unimaginable to consider that the Holy Prophet was even more impressed than some of the other prophets in our history. But obviously, that is the fact. And then we know that all our imams were incredibly oppressed. So this is just a particular sort of background, a history that these purified people share. And typically, and so when we reflect back on ourselves, okay, so these are our prophets, this is our holy prophet, these are the imams. So this is how they respond to hardships. And obviously we would say that no, they did not buckle under hardship. It had no impact on the strength of their faith, on their determination, on their patience, on their piety, on their generosity, on their kindness. But when we think about ourselves, how do we respond to hardships? If we had to undergo all the hardships that these purified people went through, how would we actually respond? So I was going to talk about that a little bit more and provide just a bit more detail. Welcome back to A to Z here on RMB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so obviously I'm talking about the idea of how do we deal with particular hardships. And in particular, in the lives of our prophets, of the Holy Prophet, of our imams, these hardships, these challenges, these huge sufferings typically would arise from a young age. So we know, for example, that obviously Prophet Muhammad is the prime example, especially as the title for this is The Orphan. So he obviously lost his father either while he was very young, obviously didn't really meet his father, or if the father was died even before he was even born. And then obviously he lost his mother when he was only about 6 years old. Then obviously his grandfather took care of him, and then his grandfather, much beloved grandfather, passed away when he was about 8 or 9 years old. And then obviously he was taken, his uncle looked after him. So huge suffering, losing all these really important people out of his life. So just imagine the amount of grief. And just imagine also, and just reflect upon the fact that we know that the Holy Prophet had these traits which were such that people would trust him, would gather around him. He was known as a trustworthy. His akhlaq was beautiful. And we can then extend that out to all the other prophets, to our imams, no matter what they went through. It did not change this beautiful heart they had on the inside. And obviously I just mentioned there the famous martyr of service, the former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi. He also lost his father when he was only 5 years old and was trying to support his family from a young age. So, you know, obviously these are... And then when we think to ourselves, how do we deal with it if we lose a loved one, if we lose a parent, if we lose a friend, a member of family, how much grief do we feel? And are we really, do we still have it in ourselves to be as kind, as generous towards other people while we're going through that grief? So obviously this is the expectation is high, but I pray that all of us can just sort of... get some strength and add to our resilience by thinking back to the examples, obviously, of our Holy Prophet and the other prophets and the imams. So inshallah, this is just, we'll gain some benefit from this for our lives. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk. On the battlefield, you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye. But then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith, go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree with many fruits. The fruits are love, courage, and resolve. You've made me a soldier, so you I salute. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. A hero.
This is Iran Radio, and I invite you to listen to some interesting facts about Islam. Islam does not have an ordained clergy or representatives of a church hierarchy in the way that Christianity does. However, every mosque has an imam, or the one who stands in front to prayer and deliver the sermon. Jesus is an important figure in the Holy Quran. Like Christians, Muslims believe in the virginal conception of Jesus by God's Spirit. However, Muslims do not believe Jesus is the Son of God. For Muslims, the concept of the Holy Trinity represents a form of polytheism. And the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. I'm so glad you've joined us. Ahead lies a schedule full of compelling discussions, stirring stories and perspectives that challenge and uplift. first we bring you Israel Watch. After this program, we have another segment of radio productions. Following this, we will shed light with the lantern. For now, please stay tuned for Israel Watch.
Thank you for joining us. The repercussions of the failed Israeli strike on Qatar targeting Hamas leaders remain the focus of analysts' comments in the Hebrew media. The war of extermination, starvation and destruction in the Gaza Strip also received the attention of Israeli commentators who are worried about escalating resistance operations. These topics will be the subject of discussion in this episode with Dr. Ali Hami, a military and strategic researcher, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Dr. Ali.
Greetings to you and to all the audience.
The failure of the Israeli strike on Qatar to assassinate Hamas leaders in Doha sparked political controversy within the Israeli entity, where one of Netanyahu's opponents, Yair Golan, announced that the Doha strike may have exposed the captives in the Gaza Strip to dangers. Dr. Ali, to begin with, do you think that the failure of the strike on Qatar to assassinate Hamas leaders, of killing Hamas leaders, as I highlighted, will actually prevent any possibility of returning to negotiations, and which automatically that will lead to the death of the captives, according to analysts?
Well, from the beginning up to now, the release of the POWs up to now is not the main issue to the Israelis' entity. Hmm. Well, at the beginning, they initiated the Hannibal Protocol, and they say they don't care about their detainees, neither the Palestinian, or they don't care about the exchange of POWs with the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And from the other hand, if we see what's the failure of the Israelis killing the Hamas leaders, but I think they succeeded to penetrate the sovereignty of Qatar despite it was successful killing and assassinating the Hamas leader or not. But it is a start. It is a start with their allies or with the American allies in the region, because they don't see Hamas or the resistance in Lebanon or the resistance axis in the region is swallowable. They start swallowing their allies.
Okay, but will that prevent any return to negotiations?
As I said, the negotiation is not the main issue. They don't care. The Israelis now, and especially Netanyahu, mm-hmm. They don't care about going back to negotiation when you try to kill the mediator and you try to eliminate the negotiators. So with whom they want to go back? Do you think there is a confidence like 0.0001% from the Palestinian delegates and the mediators of Qatar's to go back? Where? Anywhere there is a danger.
But that means that the Israelis were never serious about these negotiations from the start, and they're just buying time.
Buying time just because we know and we all know what's the goal and what's the results they want, or the outcome they need from trading such negotiation in order to benefit from the situation and to go and declare a greater Israel.
Okay, we remain on the latest Israeli strike on Qatar, which remained the focus of Israeli analysts' comments, where one of them predicted that the Americans were pre-informed about the operation targeting Hamas leadership in Doha. Doctor, what would make the United States be complicit of an attack on Qatar next to the Israelis, taking into consideration that, or given that the latter is a close U.S. ally, and this goes against the American interests?
I don't think that the Israelis has the guts to go and attack a very close ally to the United States in the region without any green light, any permission. But I don't think it was only a permission. It was a coordination and cooperation between the American and the Israelis to give a lesson to Doha not to to have any more inviting the Hamas, and not to have any safe haven to the Hamas leaders to stay in Doha. And that's what we heard from the Israeli entity representative in UN.
But does this serve the American interest?
They don't care. They are the American, they are moving from control to domination of the region. They don't care. They don't care about what you talk about after what they did in Syria, after what they are threatened Turkey, and they bombarded and attacked on
air raids. You're saying that they declared a war?
No, no, they don't need to declare a war. They are subjugating all those regions now. They think that. And as I said, they are moving from controlling to domination of the region. And they think what Israel is doing is clearing the way in order to step in as, let's say, as a helper in the region, and do that, and we will let Israel stop from attacking you. But according to military-wise, none of a small bullet, not a big airplane, they cannot reach over Qatar without the permission of United States.
So therefore, from what I'm actually understanding, according to your own analysis, Dr. Ali, is that this was an attack against Qatar, not against Hamas leaders,
exactly,
or Hamas
it's
mediators.
They are moving the stick against Qatar. Against now they are, after they paid $5.1 billion to the United States, they need about 10 to 15 years to recover such amount. And now they are very weak by using the American military equipment, because they are controlled by the American from Washington, so they cannot use it against Israel. I think they are powerless. And can you believe, just quick, can you believe when Donald Trump went last like about a couple of days ago, and he said, oh, I told Witkoff to tell the Qataris that like 10 minutes ahead of the Israeli jets reaching Doha, but he forgot to tell them. This means a very contempting against Qatar. It's like they don't consider us as states or as people.
Okay. The ongoing war on the Gaza Strip, however, and the systematic destruction of the towers did not prevent Zionist commentators from expressing their fears about the Palestinian resistance, which recently struck in Gaza and Jerusalem and killed 10 Israelis. Can Israel actually settle this conflict, Dr. Ali, bearing in mind that that they are depending on the United States, according to your own analysis, United States that has the most powerful military, according to them, wasn't able to defeat Taliban in Afghanistan and face similar problems in Iraq?
I think in Afghanistan or in Iraq, United States was leading clearly the war against Iraq and against Afghanistan. Now, United States is the shadow power, the shadow army supporting Israel and declaring that Israel is doing so, but the American who really doing all the work and the aggression against the area. We see now that all the fleets in the sea and all the air raids that are going on in the region. If you imagine that 2 years up to now, from the beginning of 7th of September, October up to now, all this kind of weapon used and all the ammunition that were used and still by the Israelis on public, in media, Israel does not have such warehouses to contain such big amount, even if the whole territory of the Israeli entity full of ammunition in 2 years, it should be empty by now.
Okay, but that's so why I asked. They are depending on the United States, which has a more powerful military.
They are not dependent on the United States.
Would they be
they
able to achieve success?
The United States is fighting. The United States, when at the beginning of the war, after the 7th of October, from here we said that Navy SEALs and Delta Force and SAS, the British, were fighting in north of Palestine, occupied Palestine, and they were fighting against Gaza. So those Western countries, especially United States and United Kingdom, they are involved in the war. They are not supporting Israel. They are doing the war, and Israel is an annexer.
But why would they risk getting that much involved, the Americans?
They are not risking anything because they are they have a deep strategic territory now with the state of normalizations in the region. They have reckless about what's gone in the Arab country and in the Islamic country, because they threaten also Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan now. So they don't care about what I think or what do you think or what's going on.
So you're saying this is an American war?
It is purely American war. Israel is only an advanced brigade.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The continuing war of extermination and starvation on the Gaza Strip does not hide the heavy losses suffered by Zionist soldiers in the face of Palestinian resistance attacks, which pushed a former occupation army officer to explain the reality of the occupation forces inside the Gaza Strip. He said that we face military weakness and that Israel cannot be strong everywhere. And these operations, the resistance operations, are obviously on the rise. How long can Israel sustain this?
From the beginning, there were no confidence between on the Israeli army, mm-hmm. and especially the infantry. We heard that at the beginning, and it was, as they said, the Israeli army was and still rusty. And if we are talking about that Israel doesn't have, the main key word is Israel does not have sufficient forces to fight against Lebanon, against Gaza. Who fought? Who fought against Lebanon and Gaza? Who tried to destroy Yemen? Who attacked Iran? Who attacked Iraq? Who attacked Doha, Qatar? If Israel doesn't have sufficient forces to finish the war with Gaza and with Lebanon. So that means, and I think he's telling the truth, from the beginning there was like disintegrating power between the politicians, the army, and the intelligence department in Israel.
But despite all this, Netanyahu moved forward.
No, not Netanyahu. I'm still insisting. Netanyahu is a puppet, is a Muppet in the hand of the American. He's trying now to blackmail the U.S. president, and he's trying now to escape a little bit to show the world that all those decisions is in his hand. This is not true.
In the hands of Trump?
No, in the hand of Netanyahu. And all what we see, Netanyahu is jumping into the unknown inside Israel. The contradictions is well in war now. They cannot bring new recruitment to the army. We see that more than 7 divisions now in Gaza trying to move from incursion to occupation. They could not do it. How come weak forces and insufficient power to go and occupy Gaza, they can go into war against Yemen and against Doha and against Iran. This is not true. United States and United Kingdom are leading the war against the area. They want, as I said before, and this is very accurate word I'm talking about,
yes,
they are moving from controlling the area to the domination.
Okay. Israeli, however, Israeli social media reacted to the continuation of the war of extermination and starvation in the Gaza Strip. Here are some of the comments.
Yair Henkelman, you will now continue to shout and call for making a deal and leaving Gaza to Gazans and allowing them to arm themselves again to kill us. Adam Landau, in the past 3 days alone, more than 7,000 people have lost their homes because of Israeli army attacks. Nir Hassan, Gaza will be the principal case study of genocide in history, and this is an unparalleled shame for Israel.
Moving to the repercussions of the European critical positions against the Israeli entity because of its crimes in the Gaza Strip and its settlement and annexation projects in the occupied West Bank and their political and economic implications for the Zionists.
I think they still play in the game of democracy and freedom around the world. And as we see, we can see all we are talking about, the repercussions of the European ban or banning some personals in the Israeli governments.
Mm-hmm.
I think they
These
should.
These are new European measures against Israel.
I think instead of doing though, they should go and punish the Israeli entity as they did.
So this is not enough in your opinion?
No, it's not enough. All what's
but
what
the
you,
Europeans
all
were
what
always
hear,
supportive to the Israelis. This is a very new dimension.
Yes,
here.
But all what you see now is temporary. Emotionally, they are supporting the Palestinians. They cannot stand just and watch. They have to say something, and they do something else. Emotionally, they support the Palestinians, but in doctrine and in principles,
mm-hmm.
they are supporting the Israelis.
Okay, so therefore the Israelis shouldn't be worried from these European
they
measures.
They are not worried. It's only propagandas. They are not worried about what's going on, and they are careless about such banning against the Israelis.
Okay, Dr. Ali Hamiyya, military and strategic researcher, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
It's one of the simplest yet most powerful words in the Islamic world, unity. And every year for 1 week, Iran marks it in a very special way. From the 12th to the 17th of Rabiul Awwal on the Islamic calendar, the days between two dates claimed as the birth date of the Prophet Muhammad, Iranians commemorate not division, but togetherness. They call it the Week of Unity. But beyond the ceremonies and conferences lies something far more important. the lived reality of Shia and Sunni Muslims in Iran, a reality often denied, distorted, or dismissed by a Western narrative that thrives on suspicion and conflict.
This week, we go behind the headlines, behind the propaganda, to witness what unity really is and why it matters.
The idea of a week of unity was born in 1980. Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, made a bold move. Where history saw differences, he saw opportunity. Sunnis celebrated the Prophet's birth on the 12th of Rabiul Awwal, Shias on the 17th. Instead of letting that divide deepen, he declared the days in between a bridge, a week of unity. To start with, we talked to Mr. Abdul Hussein Khosropanah, an Iranian Shia cleric and a professor of philosophy at the Research Institute for Islamic Culture and Thought. He is also secretary and member of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution since January 2023. He said unity is not a matter of choice. It is both a religious obligation and a rational necessity.
Muslim unity is both a religious and rational obligation. Creating division, whether by Shia or Sunni, is sinful. Imam Khomeini and the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, have always emphasized this, seeing unity not just as a defensive necessity, but as a foundation for building a new Islamic civilization. History shows that whenever Muslims were united, such as during the Buyid era, science and culture flourished.
Imam Khomeini didn't ask Sunnis to become Shias or Shias to become Sunnis. He asked Muslims to be Muslims together, to emphasize what we share: God, the Prophet, the Holy Quran, and the hope for justice.
Mr. Khosropanah emphasized, however, that unity does not mean erasing differences. He said that Sunni and Muslim scholars must join forces to confront the greater challenges of our time.
None of our great scholars, whether Ayatollah Brujerdi, Imam Khomeini, or the leader of the revolution, ever said unity means one sect must abandon its beliefs. Shia and Sunni scholars can and should discuss differences respectfully and academically. But today, there are far more pressing challenges than sectarian disputes. Secularism, relativism, and atheistic ideologies are pushing youth toward disbelief and moral permissiveness. These are the critical issues where Shia and Sunni scholars must cooperate. Likewise, in advanced sciences such as quantum technology, biotechnology, or artificial intelligence, no single Muslim country can succeed alone. By dividing responsibilities and collaborating, they can avoid falling into modern forms of dependency and subjugation.
The Holy Quran itself calls for this bond in chapter 3, verse 103. Hold fast to the rope of Allah all together and do not be divided. A command, not a suggestion. We also had the opportunity to meet with Mr. Maulavi Muhammad Ishaq Madani, a prominent Sunni scholar and former member of the Assembly of Experts for Leadership. He emphasized the importance of unity not only between Shia and Sunni Muslims, but also among all followers of divine religions.
The Quran commands, hold firmly to the rope of God and do not be divided. If we fight among ourselves, we weaken and lose our strength. The Prophet said, be brothers forever. Do not strike each other's necks. He compared believers to bricks in a wall, each strengthening the other. The Holy Quran also reminds us that all prophets, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace be upon them, brought the same divine message. Just as we respect our prophet, we are obliged to honor all the prophets.
And the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, built his community on this principle. In Medina, tribes and cultures blended into one ummah. It was unity, not wealth or power, that turned Islam into a global force. But unity has always had enemies. For centuries, colonial powers understood that a united Muslim world was the one thing they could not control. Their answer? Divide and rule.
Our enemies, whoever they may be, use division as a tool for domination. The old saying goes, divide and rule. Even before Islam, this strategy was used. For example, when Jewish tribes settled in Medina, though small in number, they fueled conflict between the Aws and the Khazraj tribes, allowing themselves to dominate. And it was the prophet of Islam who united these tribes, and the plotters then became his enemies. Division has always been a weapon of domination, and it is still being used against us today.
The strategy was brutally effective, stoking suspicion, fabricating lies, turning brothers into rivals. Shias were branded as heretics, Sunnis painted as oppressors. The damage was not accidental, it was engineered. For Mr. Khosropanah, the concept of unity extends beyond Iran. He sees the global resistance movement as its natural outcome, a front where Sunnis, Shias, and even Christians stand together against occupation and oppression.
The global resistance movement is another fruit of unity. The Zionist regime targets both Sunni and Shia leaders alike, whether it be the Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, Ismail Haniya, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, or General Qasem Soleimani. Their struggle is shared. Before the revolution, even Lebanon's Shia community was fragmented, manipulated by colonial powers. Today, however, resistance unites Shia, Sunnis, and even Christians in Lebanon. Attempts to disarm Hezbollah fail because many Sunnis and Christians also see its weapons as essential for Lebanon's security. This shows that the theory of unity directly leads to the theory of resistance.
The professor of philosophy at the Research Institute for Islamic Culture and Thought also pointed to the ambitions of the Zionist regime, whose plans for expansion threaten the entire Muslim world. Division, he warns, only makes it easier for such enemies to prevail.
We also face a common external enemy, the Zionist regime, which seeks not only to occupy Palestine, but to expand from the Nile to the Euphrates, threatening parts of Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Egypt, Qatar, and even Iran. Such ambitions endanger all Muslims, Shia and Sunni alike. Unity is necessary to resist this cancerous tumor. The Quran warns that division weakens us, and once weakened, enemies can easily destroy us. Their goal is not limited to Gaza. They seek to fragment nations and enslave peoples.
Western empires knew very well that if Muslims stood as one, foreign domination would crumble. So they invested in division, sometimes with guns, sometimes with whispers.
At the Azadi Hotel, we met several Muslim scholars from different countries who had come to Iran to participate in a conference marking the Week of Unity. Among them was Sidi Mohammadi Quadrego from Burkina Faso.
For the West, it makes no difference whether a Muslim is Shia or Sunni. Their goal is to weaken Islam as a whole. I see Islam like a body. Shias and Sunnis are its limbs. If the limbs fight each other, the enemy can easily sever the head. Disagreements among Muslims should never destroy their shared purpose. Our goal must be unity, otherwise the enemies of Islam will exploit our divisions, as we see today in Gaza and elsewhere.
Today, the echoes of that policy live on in extremist groups, in sectarian wars, and in the headlines of Western media, eager to portray Islam as fractured and Iran as divided. But here's the truth. On the ground in the streets of Iran, the story is very different. Ms. Zainab Salem, a Muslim researcher from Iraq who has been living in Iran, shares the impressions of visitors to Iran, who discover a society very different from the image shown abroad, lively, secure, and thriving through Islam. For her, Iran's strength is living proof of the power of unity. A relative of mine recently visited Iran from Canada. She was surprised to see how lively, joyful, and secure life is here, completely different from the negative image presented abroad. True life and dignity come from living by Islam, its beliefs, and its values. Iran is proof of this. In medicine, education, science, and culture, it thrives through Islam. Foreigners may deny this, but those who visit with their own eyes see the truth. Iran's strength is the strength of Islam, and unity here is real in a way the outside world does not show. Meanwhile, another guest from Pakistan shared his experience of living in Iran. Mr. Sayyid Hassan Reza Naqvi, a PhD candidate at the University of Tehran, has been residing in the capital for the past 5 years.
I have close ties with Iranian Sunni students in Chabahar, Zahedan, Golestan, and Gurgan, as well as with Pakistani students across Iran, since I'm responsible for the Urdu-speaking Student Association. From what I have observed, the relations between Shia and Sunni youth in Iranian universities are an example for the rest of the Muslim world. In some countries, Shias make up 25% of the population, yet they have no presence in government, not even as a mid-level manager or a military officer. In another country, Shias make up nearly half the population, yet they have no governors. By contrast, in Iran, the governor of Sistan and Balochistan is a Sunni Baloch. Sunnis also serve as members of parliament, professors in universities, and officials across different sectors. Sunni and Shia students face no restrictions. This culture of inclusion and mutual respect in Iran should be presented as a model to other Muslim countries. Unlike elsewhere, sectarian sensitivities do not dominate relations here. Students treat one another like brothers. Personally, I'm very happy to see it.
During the eight-year Iran-Iraq war when Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist army invaded with Western backing, Shia and Sunni Iranians fought side by side. Thousands of Sunnis gave their lives defending their homeland. In those trenches, unity was not a slogan, it was survival. When the bullets came, they didn't ask if they were Shia or Sunni. They were Iranians. They were Muslims. They were brothers.
From the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has faced attacks, whether from terrorist groups like the MEK, separatist groups in Kurdistan, or extremist movements in Balochistan. These groups shed both Shia and Sunni blood. During the eight-year war, Sunni scholars and fighters stood shoulder to shoulder with Shias in defense of Iran. At every stage, unity has been the key to survival.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Welcome to the news section of the program, where we take a look at different headlines from different news outlets. Mehr News. Tehran celebrates Islamic Unity Week with cultural festival. A cultural festival was held in Tehran with the presence of Foreign Minister Sayyid Abbas Araghchi, Tehran Mayor Ali Reza Zalkani, along with officials, ambassadors, and representatives of various countries. The Rahmatan Lil Alamin Festival, coinciding with Unity Week, showcased the cultural and religious traditions of various ethnic groups in Iranian provinces. IRNA, Islamic Unity Conference to convene in Tehran with participation of global scholars. The 39th International Islamic Unity Conference was held with the participation of 80 prominent scholars, 210 guests, and 2,800 activists from across the Muslim world. The event was attended both in person and virtually by scholars and intellectuals from various countries. Speaking at a press conference, the Secretary General of the World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought outlined three dimensions of unity, including domestic, regional, and international, saying domestic unity in Iran has served as a model for the Muslim world, citing examples such as the broad solidarity displayed during the 12-day Israeli war against the country. Shahriari noted that thousands of statements and Friday sermons by Sunni clerics after the war reflected a shared commitment to unity, with a collection of those sermons soon to be published. He also dismissed claims of division, saying rare incidents are often exaggerated by hostile media to undermine solidarity among Muslims. Tehran Times. 63 coins bearing Prophet Muhammad's name to be unveiled in Unity Week. Iran unveiled 63 historical coins inscribed with the name of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, for the first time during Islamic Unity Week. Hamid Reza Soleimani, head of the Dafine Museum's group, said the coins were presented on Sunday, September 7th, at a ceremony marking the 1500th anniversary of the Prophet's birth. The event took place at the Shahid Zahidi Hall of the Mostazafan Foundation in Tehran, he added. Soleimani said the 63 coins symbolizing the years of the Prophet's life were selected from the foundation's treasury of historic currency. Following the unveiling, they will be on public display for 2 weeks at the Astana Quds Razavi Museum in Mashhad. The collection includes some of the most prominent gold dinars and silver dirhams from across the Islamic world, Soleimani said. The oldest coin dates back to the 7th century CE, while the most recent belongs to Iran's Qajar period. He said the coins span multiple dynasties, including the Abbasids, Samanids, Aghlabids, Tulunids, Ghaznavids, Ghurids, Seljuks, Ilkhanids, Taymurids, Safavids, Afsharids, and Qajars. Their geographic origins include the Indian subcontinent, Central Asia, Iran, Mesopotamia, the Levant, and North Africa. Ilna. Pezeshkian emphasizes need for strengthening Islamic unity. Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian and head of the National Iraqi Alliance, Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, emphasized the importance of unity among Islamic countries. In a meeting on September 8th, the Iranian president highlighted that ongoing collaboration among Islamic nations is essential for development and resilience against the external pressures. The Iranian officials believe that continuous unity and cooperation among Islamic countries in all areas will not only pave the way for development and progress, but no power will be able to sanction or defeat Muslim nations, Pezeshkian said. Regarding Iran-Iraq relationship, the president reaffirmed that geographical borders cannot affect the deep-rooted ties between the Iranian and Iraqi peoples, which are fortified by shared religious and cultural bonds. He warned against divisive issues that could undermine Islamic unity, urging vigilance against plots by adversaries aiming to create discord. This brings us to the end of this section. Please stay tuned as we go back to our main narrative. Today, that unity is visible at the highest levels. An example is Shahram Irani, a Sunni from Kurdistan who commands Iran's navy. His rise to leadership is more than personal success. It's proof that segregation walls are not what outsiders claim. In Iran's Sunni-majority regions, from Kurdistan to Sistan and Baluchistan, mosques are active, Friday prayers are held, and Sunni representatives sit in parliament. Their voices are not silenced. Their faith is not hidden. But this is not the story told in the West. Instead, Iran is painted as a land of sectarian oppression, where Sunnis are silenced, where unity is a mask, where division festers beneath the surface.
One of the most important lessons we can learn from Iran is the model of representation and coexistence. Here, even non-Muslims, I mean Christians and Jews, can vote and hold seats in parliament. This is a remarkable example that other countries should adopt. It shows that Iran recognizes humanity and human dignity, rooted in both the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Prophet and his family.
And when misinformation fails, violence is manufactured. Groups fueled by foreign support preach sectarian hatred, bomb mosques, and claim to speak for Islam. But their mission is not faith. It is fracture. Mr. Naqvi recalled the early days of Israel's war on Iran when he witnessed a spirit of unity, not only between Shia and Sunni Muslims within Iran, but also between the people of Iran and Pakistan, standing together in the face of a common enemy.
During the early days of the war, on the second day, the Pakistani embassy asked all students to return home since universities and dormitories had closed. They even arranged transportation to the Mirjan.